This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Picking premises for page turners.
Rogue archaeology in Crimea.
Robin as creative director.
And Bugsy Siegel versus Goebbels and Goering.
I'm Ken.
And I'm Robin.
And we're talking about stuff. Specifically, Robin, we're talking about a phenomenon that occurs every January. No, not the sudden surge in gym memberships that vanishes by the Ides of March, but something far more transformative for the tabletop landscape.
You mean New Game Master Month, Ken? The time when we take the uninitiated, those who've spent their lives safely on the player's side of the screen, and gently push them into the glorious yet terrifying spotlight of the Game Master's chair.
It's a transition more profound than any alchemical transmutation. And this year, for those who want their first foray into GMing to be as approachable as a warm sunbeam, Magical Kitties Save the Day is a featured game.
It's the perfect starting point for new GMs. While you and I can spend hours debating the occult significance of 19th century Parisian sewers, some people just want to play a really cute kitty who can throw fireballs.
And let's be honest, Robin, compared to some of the eldritch horrors we've summoned in the consulting occultist hut, a hyper-intelligent raccoon is a refreshingly manageable antagonist.
Exactly. If you've been pausing...
Oh no, here we go.
If you've been pausing before taking the leap, New Game Master Month provides a free step-by-step seminar starting in January at newgamemastermonth.com. It's a series of twice-weekly posts that guide you through every moment of preparation.
You get expert advice, a supportive community, and an easy entry game designed to be run by those who find a 400-page rule book a bit
hysterical.
I was not going to say that. No.
By February, you'll be an actual GM. It really is the cat's pajamas of intro workshops. So don't let your New Year's resolutions be a tale of woe.
Go to newgamemastermonth.com to sign up for the totally free seminar.
And remember, in the world of Magical Kitties Save the Day, the only thing more powerful than your magic is your personality.
I'm ending the segment now, Robin.
Fair, I think I used up my 9 lives on that last one.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the friendly confines of the gaming hut. But this is not the regular gaming hut with the pool table in the corner and the old video game console by the terrible analog TV. No, this is a gaming hut that is it in the church basement? Is it in mom's study? Because there's nothing but good books here, Robin. There's nothing but literature. That's going to ruin everything, unless...
It might even be in a library. Who knows?
Who can say? Unless, Robin, it's a game that uses literary tropes and concepts to build interpersonal drama. A game such as Page Turners, your brand new game of one-to-one literary role-playing drama. And although Page Turners itself comes with many, many wonderful stories in it, scenarios, at some point, one will run through that book. And now this is where we discuss how to figure out what might make a Page Turners scenario of your own devising. And I'm assuming, Robin, that as the global expert on this topic, you have more thoughts than none.
Yes, exactly. So as you say, Page Turners, which is at the printers and probably at this point mostly printed and ready to ship, is a game that focuses on a single main character. So first of all, your question is the thing that you have in mind about one person? Is there a single character whose viewpoint we follow throughout, or is it an ensemble piece that cuts between different characters? And if it's an ensemble piece, you can either use Hillfolk, a drama system for that, and get a group of players, or you can see if you can rearrange it so that it focuses more on a single person. So, for example, Shakespeare's comedies are ensemble pieces. You don't follow this one actor is not on stage throughout. But you can adapt that to a single protagonist the way that the Shakespearean comedy scenario that I wrote for the book does. And it tells you to select a character and it will still feel like a Shakespearean character, whether you pick the maid or the clever servant. Those are the two possible protagonists. And it will feel like a Shakespearean comedy, even though you're following one person throughout. So some things that are inherently ensemble pieces can be readily adapted. So for example, if you wanted to do something like Succession, you could just pick one of the characters or allow the player to pick from a number of different characters, and then you would just follow that character and have them in every scene. So it'd be like a version of Succession where the Kieran Culkin character is in every single scene. It's different from the original, but it still works.
Right.
However, there are still plenty of stories that focus on a single character. And the trick here is getting references that everyone shares, because those of us in the nerd tribe all kind of follow and share the same reference points for procedural things, whether that's Star Wars or Star Trek or Lord of the Rings or whatever, things about tackling external obstacles and having adventures. Although I think everybody listening to this is familiar with a story with a single character, which is about their emotional journey and is not about their solving problems. Having one example that I can put before you is tougher. So recent films that I've seen that follow this model, Roofman, where Channing Tatum plays a real life burglar who winds up hiding out in a compartment inside a Toys R Us and meets one of the employees there and sort of forms a relationship with her. And that follows his journey. We see everything from his point of view. There may be the occasional scene that doesn't have him in it, but most everything does.
Right.
Another example of a single protagonist drama recently is Jay Kelly, where George Clooney plays a movie star who's undergoing a bit of a personal journey as he reckons with his past and his family and his neglect as a father. Again, there are definitely scenes in that move away from him and show other characters. For example, there's a really interesting scene between Adam Sandler, who plays his longstanding manager, and another client. But you could still absolutely do that in Page Turners. You just wouldn't have that scene. You would have the later scene with the George Clooney character talking to the Adam Sandler character and the Sandler character revealing, as he does in the film, that he's been dumped by the other client.
Right.
So that's the first test. Single protagonist.
Now, there are many movies with single protagonists that are either procedural stories and therefore not ideally suited to page turners. So although, you know, The Dark Knight has a single protagonist, you basically follow through the whole thing. You probably would not play Batman in page turners, even if you were doing a real, you know, do I come out of retirement and save Gotham, you know, self-questioning type Batman. It probably still wouldn't be ideal for page turners, because at some point you'd want to, you know, murk a bunch of hoods, and the game doesn't quite encourage that. Am I correct here?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And that's the second test. Is it a dramatic story, or can you play it as a primarily dramatic story, one of internal emotional transformation, or is it a procedural? And as I was sort of suggesting, chances are, if you're a fan of genre, even the things that you think of as being about mundane people are very typically actually still procedural. So for example, The Maltese Falcon, it definitely has an emotional angle to it, but it's also an investigation. So that's better suited for Gumshoe One-to-One than it would be for page turners. So anything that's basically has an investigation, that's a problem-solving situation. Anything involving action and overcoming enemies physically, so that's your Batman, that's your James Bond, that's your Robin Hood. You could do a Robin Hood story.
And it's also all sports movies would be, so no F1, no Marty Supreme, no Pride of the Yankees either.
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think you could do a sports biopic, but if the end of the film hinges on, do we win the big game? If that's the point,
right,
with a big, long, suspenseful sequence about whether you win the game, and it's up in the air as to whether, you know, it's a happy ending or a sad ending, depending on whether you win, that doesn't work.
Right.
However, you could absolutely do, particularly like a sports biopic like Marty Supreme, I bet you could do that if it's never about, does he win this match, but about, you just decide whether he wins or loses appropriately, and then you have his emotional reaction to that. And so you could have a fictional athlete who the question is, how do they cope with failure with all the people around them who they care about, or how do they cope with success and the possible destructiveness of success to their relationship? So you could actually absolutely do a sports narrative, as long as it's not like, you know, like Hoosiers, whether you win the big game or not. But you could certainly do Field of Dreams, for example.
So The Natural, being a classic sports narrative about the internal moral decision-making of the baseball player, is also a myth. What about solo character mythic stories like The Green Knight? Is that a page turner's possibility? Or if you're getting into myths, are you just almost too definitionally gotta kill a monster? Although The Green Knight, of course, doesn't ever have to kill a monster, that being the problem that he faces, really.
Right. So the question is not whether the character is ever depicted overcoming an external obstacle, but whether you're comfortable just saying, oh yeah, he kills the monster here. If you can do that, okay, I've killed the monster and I'm back, and I then come and throw the monster's head in front of my brother, the king, that works absolutely. But if the end of your scenario, you picture that turning on the question of whether you successfully kill the monster, and that's in doubt, and you have to use tactics and powers, that's not a page-turner's thing. Right. So an interesting question then is, if there's a genre you like, is there a way to take out the procedural suspense from it and still have a story? So as you suggest, you know, you could still do Batman is dying and he gathers all the people in his life to try and make amends for all the ways that he's wronged them in his pursuit of justice and putting that ahead of others. You could absolutely do that. But you would, first of all, your player would have to understand that that's part of the deal just as much as you do. And baked into the premise would be, you know, there's no fight with the Joker at the end.
Yeah.
There's possibly recriminations with Alfred about that time that you abandoned him to go fight the Joker. But the suspenseful external obstacle part is not a part of the deal. So the other thing is, although you could certainly take things, genres that we're used to doing in typical procedural role playing, and then take the procedural elements out of them, another more obvious thing to do is to take something that works that way in the first place.
Yeah.
So another thing to do is to take a look at your favorite works of literary or dramatic fiction and do something that references that. And that is what Page Turners does. By, there's a Shakespeare one, as I mentioned, there's a Fitzgerald pastiche, there's a Jane Austen pastiche. You don't have to base them on literary references, but that's certainly an easy way to go, especially if you share the same reference points. So if the player that you're designing this for, you know, they're a big fan of a sort of hard-hitting 50s dramas, you could look at On the Waterfront and think of something that is like that, that is set in the same milieu or carries on one of the other characters. Or again, just look at your DVD shelf or your bookshelf and find something that follows that. So often a good tip-off that you've got a solo book or one that follows a single character and makes the most important character is their name is in the title. So
yeah.
Doing Anya Karenina is easier than doing War and Peace, for example.
Right.
And that's a way to kind of narrow it down to a manageable size of intense dramatic storyline.
Now, that leads us to question, let's say you're doing Anna Karenina, and to do a proper Anna Karenina, she has to be steadily stripped of hope and personal illusion until she throws herself under a train, spoiler. In a Page Turner's Anna Karenina, does the player knowing the end make it better in the sense that you are basically collaborating to live out this known life story? The same thing would happen with a biopic, as you say, where, you know, nope, I know that, you know, Lou Gehrig has to resign from the Yankees because of his disease. It's too sad, but that's where we're playing toward. Or is it the point of page-turners that while you are Anna Karenina, it is possible for you to dramatically regain your sense of selfhood and not end it all at the end. And that's what you're doing in terms of that's what's adding the sort of, I don't want to say procedural, but the will they or won't they juice that you get out of more conventional role-playing scenarios and even out of a lot of drama system games where you've got two poles, but you're clearly rooting for one over the other one.
What you do with a page-turner scenario is you decide at the beginning which of the following outcomes are possible. So you can specify if you want to do the tragic ending of Anna Karenina, you specify that it moves toward doom. If you want to leave it open that it could lead to a happy or a sad ending, you can specify that this could lead toward union, which is the happy ending, the reconciliation, the redemption, which can be internal or with other characters, or doom. Or you can leave ambiguous as a possible ending where the character carries on. We're not necessarily sure whether they had a happy ending and sad ending and conclude the story. And so
we,
you can
end with her getting to the train station. We don't know if she's going to get on a train and go to Germany or if she's going to throw herself under it.
Right. Or, you know, she manages to, you know, salvage a few scraps of her dignity and get away. And she's overall worse off, but maybe she's learned a tragic lesson or whatever. So ambiguous doesn't necessarily mean that you leave the ending open and don't show where the character has gone, but that you don't, how you feel about that is ambiguous.
Right.
So at any rate, what you would do is you possibly agree with the player ahead of time, which of the choices that you use, or in some cases, you know, if you're doing a Macbeth pastiche, obviously that has to go toward doom. It will be deeply unsatisfying, right? If you're doing Oedipus, if you're doing, you know, any Greek tragedy, it'll be weird if, you know, Oedipus just wins at the end and goes, well, I made a few mistakes, but on the whole, I think I'm a pretty good leader here.
But look at the GNP of Thebes, everybody. Look at that.
Yeah, exactly. So that's how you solve that is by knowing in advance and by having the player, although they're intensely identifying with their character, also have the authorial sense that you may be intentionally moving toward the dark ending that unifies a lot of literary stories.
Well, rather than move toward our own dark ending, let us stop at the train station and also at the end of this segment and wait for a beloved ad to give us something to live for and hope for again. Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming in February from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
A Childhood Haunted by Strife and a Shadowy Being,
Deceit and Survival on the Spaceship Earth Again,
A Stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austen-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement,
The Screwball 30s Hijinks of Loose Screws,
The Shakespearean Comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers,
A Love Triangle Unfolding from the Turbulent 60s to the Troubled 20-teens,
Behind the Music Drama in the L.A. Punk Scene,
The Arrival of a Telepathic Stranger on a Spacebound Way Station,
Tragic Love Between a Vampire and a Mortal,
and an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to union doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
The clack of the pickaxe. The comforting feel of the pith helmet on your head and possibly some LIDAR being pumped into the ground tell us that we're once more standing in the Doric columned archaeology hut. And this time around, I thought we would take a look at an interesting current archaeology story where a Russian archaeologist was arrested in Poland for allegedly destroying the ancient city of Myrmekion, which is in Crimea. And once you think about a Russian archaeologist working in occupied Crimea and the fact that these charges were brought by the Ukrainian authorities, that creates an interesting question mark around the story. But I'm willing to stick with, as we said in the intro, rogue archaeology as something's going on, because I think if you're conducting archaeology in an occupied territory, that's as rogue as I want to think about. So Ken, I guess first tell us what the site is that he allegedly significantly damaged.
Yes, Myrmekion is a Ionian colony founded by Greeks from the Ionian coast of Asia Minor, circa 575 BC. And from the city of Miletus in Ionia, they'd sent a previous colony called Panticapaeon about 25 years before then, so around 600 BC. And it was at the tip end of the Crimean Peninsula. So if you... Crimea is a big diamond, and on the eastern point of the diamond, that's where Panticapaeon and Myrmekion are. Myrmekion is about 2.5 miles east of Panticapaeon. There's a little headland that juts out into the Sea of Azov, and that's where Myrmekion is. And both of these cities are now underneath basically the Russian city of Kerch, which grew up in medieval times on the site of the Greek colonies. But back in the classical time, the colonies are small enough that they're out there at the literal end of the world to the ancient Greeks. And indeed, Myrmekion was destroyed by Scythians around 465 BC. They found arrowheads all over the site. The buildings all got burned down. And then they see that people built walls really fast after that. So the notion is the Greek settlers ran to Panticapaeon and then came back when the Scythians had left and said, all right, this time we're going to put walls up. We're not going to be fooled again. With their cunning walls, by about 300 BC, they've hit maximum population, which is still not very maximum because they're always going to be kind of a satellite city of Panticapaeon. So the estimates range from 800 to 1600 people living in Myrmekion based on the amount of cleared space.
Yes. The places we call cities in the ancient period are not cities at all by our current reckoning.
Right. I mean, it's a city because it has the charter of a city. It's a political city, but it's not a particularly thriving city state. Although they do make wine and garum. They've found the wine pits and the garum dredging area where they dried the fish out on the shore. And then its job was to trade grain, which came down the Borysthenes, which is what they called the Dnieper in that day, and the Don. And they traded the grain to Greece, and Greece sent them manufactured items. So although they made some of their own pottery there, a lot of their pottery came from Greece, a lot of their household goods came from Greece, and one assumes knives and axes and mirrors and other stuff that the Scythians did not want to be bothered to sit around and make, they would get from Myrmekion and Panticapaeon. So it's a thriving trade entrepot. And by this time, all of these cities have been unified in what is called the Bosporan Kingdom. And this is the northern Bosporus, the southern Bosporus being the one we all know about near Byzantium, future Istanbul. So this is the Sumerian Bosporus, the northern Bosporus, and it's got its own kingdom, which is all these city-states have basically given a local warlord authority to defend them from Scythians and whatnot. So the Bosporan kingdom is centered at Panticapaeon. So this is not great for Myrmekion's, you know, civic identity. It eventually just becomes sort of a bedroom community or a vacation destination, like the fancy neighborhood of Panticapaeon. And probably we know that it got a mysterious mound or tumulus, probably right about the time that it was made part of the Bosporan Kingdom, so back in the 2nd century BC, and then in the second century AD, 150 to 170 AD, they built a giant thing that they know is a royal tomb because they found the sarcophagus in 1837, but they don't know whose royal tomb it was because I guess it wasn't labeled, or the guys in 1837 carried off all the writing and didn't make a note of it. So it's one of two Bosporan kings, probably either Eupator or the guy before him, Roy Metallus. And so we don't know, but it's probably a Bosporan king. So now it's got both the sanctity of having a royal tomb there, but also it's not super convenient to build new houses. Eventually, the whole area is razed and depopulated by the Huns when they invade around 380 AD, and that is the official end of Myrmecion. And when it comes back as Kerch and passes out of our story.
So now the next part of the story is Alexander Butyagin, who has been the head of archaeology at this site long before the occupation, but has either been up to no good and has now been charged on that basis, or has been subject to harassment, as the Russians are arguing. But tell us a bit about him and what he's discovered there.
Yeah, Alexander Butyagin is a archaeologist. He, you know, has been studying Myrmecion his whole career. His undergraduate thesis was on Myrmecion, and eventually joins the staff of the Hermitage, the big museum in St. Petersburg, and rose to become head of Black Sea archaeology there in 2005. He's been heading the Myrmecion expedition, which is the dig site, since 1999. So well before the Russian annexation of Crimea. So back in the palmy days of the early 2000s, he must have been getting along at least to some degree with the Ukrainian authorities.
Right. So he's published extensively on the site. He's written a whole bunch of papers in various archaeological journals, either in Russian. There's also a bunch of them that are in Italian because he collaborates with Italian scholars who, are, I guess, presumably are writing the text based on his research. So he has turned out a lot of material on this site, and presumably even the things you've told us in the first bit are the knowledge we have of it are owed to him.
A big chunk of it, certainly. Yeah, I imagine the things like, oh yeah, we know they made wine and garum. That's probably right down to Alexander Butyagin. That's probably not any czarist archaeologist.
And he's written everything from broad papers on economics to here's a particular ceramic item that I'm analyzing. So he's within his purview there at Myrmecion. He studies a wide range of things from a variety of different angles.
Yeah, he's the absolute expert on the site. In 2002, he found a hoard of bronze coins there, found in 2003 a hoard of electrum coins, which I love that these alloy coins are up here at the edge of nowhere. But 2022 is when he hits pay dirt, and they found a big gold hoard. And Butyagin has also curated some exhibitions at the Hermitage, including one on the mask without a face. I don't know what it's about because it's all in Russian. And another one on the site of monsters. So the Hermitage is, like every other museum in the world, not above sexing up an archaeological dig. But if he's finding masks without faces and monsters, then maybe we can start nerd-troping this thing.
Yes, he's helping out with the second part of this segment.
Right. In 2024, the Ukrainian government notices that this archaeological dig has been ongoing, or finally gets down to that part of the inbox, and indicts Butyagin for illegally excavating in occupied Crimea, which it's been occupied since 2014. To the Russians, it's not occupied Crimea, it's just regular Crimea, and they don't need to send any stupid permission slips to the Ukrainian government. And since it's an illegal excavation, they're alleging that there has been damage to it because the Ukrainians haven't been there to sign off on all the excavating. And they've set the amount of the damage at 4.77 million. And I have no idea what percentage of the site that would indicate, but he's no doubt been digging trenches through the whole thing because that's how you do excavating now.
Yeah. So there's one part of the accusation that says that he's dug down to like 2.5 meters in various places. Mm-hmm. And so what we can't evaluate, because we don't have a neutral observer on hand to tell us what's going on, whether this is normal modern Western archaeology and it's being spun in a direction to strike out at this guy because he's a Russian at a site in Ukraine, or whether current Russian archaeology is somewhat brutal and crude and follows the, it's sort of possibly a throwback to the old dig everything out, sort it out later theory from 100 years ago. And I can imagine either being true, but I don't know which is true.
Right. He goes to Poland to take part in an academic conference and give a lecture. And this is when the Ukrainians serve their arrest warrant to the Polish government. So the Polish government arrests him in Warsaw. And this was on December 4th. And he's got until, you know, by now, by the air date of this, we'll know, or someone will know, whether or not he's been extradited or released, because the Polish government had a, like a 40-day deadline. And I don't think that the holidays count for that. So he may have been extradited to Ukraine 2 weeks ago, or he may be back in Russia fuming and writing angry letters to Archaeology Today. Who can say? But in the sort of the filing to protest the arrest, the Hermitage has said that all the relics dug up since 2014 have been kept in Crimean museums. None of them have been, you know, looted to Russia. And the, okay, all right. Some of them were sent to Russia. We're not denying that, but they were only sent for restoration and needed cleaning and whatnot. And then they went right back to Crimea, and how dare you? And again, this is the statement of an official Russian government body. So take that for what it's worth. But on the other hand, the Hermitage is by and large, I think, considered to be, you know, maybe not the most ethical museum in the universe, but it's not a pirate outfit. This is a place with a reputation that will need to have a reputation even after Putin, you know, goes to, you know, join his ancestors in the wall of the Kremlin or whatever.
So the question is, in Night Spike Agents, which seems like the starting point here, since this is a story that has a geopolitical angle to it and therefore could interest a burned spy or two, I guess really our question is, what is actually in that tomb, and does it periodically come out, and is it part of a conspiracy?
Right. And I think that most often when you think a big mound in Scythia, you're thinking of like the Kurgan from Highlander and a really cool Kurgan burial. And I'm sure that there's been lots of Kurgans blown open in the war, and that would be a whole other story. But in this case, we're talking about proper Hellenized vampires. So we're talking about a guy in robes. He looks all sophisticated. He's got a taste for wine and Vietnamese food, because fish sauce is as close as you can get to garum now, maybe. And also, he wants to drink your blood because he's a vampire. So yeah, I feel like either the mysterious tumulus that went up when Myrmikaon was made part of the Bosporan Kingdom, or as you suggest, the mysterious tomb that we don't know whose it is somewhere that a local vampire has arisen. And I feel like the fact that they don't find the gold until 2022, despite having dug there since 1999, means that the vampire must have revealed it. And I think that might have been his buy-in. Like, he wants to join the conspiramid, and this is him, you know, showing up to the poker table and cashing in some of his gold for some chips. And so this is a new and ambitious member of the conspiramid. He grew up in the universal knife fight that was Hellenistic court politics. So he has no, you know, patience for any codes or pavans that might have been invented by the vampires in the last 100 years. And he is a player. And he wants to be a player. And Butyagin is, of course, his Renfield. And he's been guiding him to excavate ever more of the Greek mysteries on the site. And maybe even has been pointing him to some of the old Barrow Mound energy, where there's been possible Draugrs and Vorthers and things buried, if not by the Scythians, then possibly by the Vikings who were down here back in the day. So he's building up his army, his private army in Crimea under the cover of the war. And he's probably arming them with an awful lot of great military gear, especially if he knows when a Russian arsenal is about to get rocketed and he shows up, and when the guards are all gone, his men move in and take everything that is still working. So I feel like this guy, let's call him Eupator, just because that's one of the guys that it could be. Eupator the vampire he's ready for action. And he is, you know, maybe going to try and make his play in Russian court politics, or maybe he's just waiting for the final artifact to be dug up so that he can get out of the Black Sea and go to, you know, civilized Greece and start over again, which is no doubt what he had as his life's ambition back when he was king of a miserable outpost at the end of the world in 150 AD.
And if he's raising an undead army, and equipping them with AK-47s, modern day standards of archaeology, and making sure you map everything and its relationship to each other in sight in order to write academic papers. That is not his concern.
Not his priority.
That could, in fact, explain why satellite imagery has turned up disturbing holes and barrows and mounds at the site. And
he's been guiding Butyagin to the vampire power stuff that was buried down there, the magic artifacts from Miletus.
Right. And so that could explain why Poland is willing to act against the Renfield in this, and they're taking their action to try and stop him, or at least to removing the foremost human member of this organization is at least going to slow them down. And so the question for the player characters is this action part of a good guy anti-vampire effort, or is it just another rival vampire trying to stop this relative upstart from showing up, and or this throwback from showing up and messing everything up?
Right. And it could go either way. And that's what you have to investigate in Poland. And everything you find out indicates you really have to go into the Ukrainian war zone and deal with stuff, because even if it's being thwarted by, you know, another, a good guy organization, you know, the Vatican or whoever doesn't have the resources to send a team of vampire hunters into the occupied Crimea. That's more your remit, former CIA guys.
Well, now that we've got a rip from the headlines, Knight's Black Agents scenario ready for you, I think we can safely head to the next hot and/or segment. In the Spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Accept this podcast premise by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Darren Bretz,
Lewis R. Evans,
Pedro Garcia,
Kevin H.,
and Tennant Reed.
It's time once again to ask Ken and Robin. Beloved Patreon backer Fred Kish asks Robin, what's this creative director gig all about? Referring to your new position high atop the dizzying Pelgrane Press table of organization pyramid.
Yeah, so since March, I've had the title of creative director, and my mission has been to take over some of the jobs on Kat Tobin's plate and make books come out. And jokingly, although it's not really a joke, so basically Pelgrane, if you like Pelgrane stuff, which I can't imagine how you're accidentally listening
you're just to this podcast. Listening to this podcast through gritted teeth. Don't. Damn it. What are they going to talk about Shadowrun?
Yeah. So Pelgrane has created what it has created with an incredibly small staff of people. And many of those people so far have been Kat Tobin, the publisher and co-owner. And if you've been wondering why it takes a long time for books to come out and they haven't been clear release dates, that's because she's been trying to do too much for too long. And so she's brought me in for a couple of reasons. And the most obvious one is to get the production stream working. So oddly enough, because Kat had and still has too many jobs, by trying to take one job off her hand, I've sort of, at least for a while, gotten 3 to 4 different jobs as well, which I'm doing half time because I'm also continuing to write things. At this point, I'm focusing on writing things for Pelgrane. And it's annoying to me as creative director that one of my key writers is busy half the time. Not turning in things quickly enough. And that's something that I hope to be able to regularize a bit more in the months ahead. So I held on to this question for a little while because I wanted to wait until at least some glimmering was on the horizon that the work I've been doing since March is beginning to pay off. And so in 2026, you'll start to see more books coming out. The drought will end. So I'm partly also currently doing the duties of a production manager. And the creative directing stuff that I've been doing, the commissioning new projects, it will still be quite a while before those start to appear, because even in a publishing company with a larger staff, the window it takes from inception to publication of a product is really long. But eventually there will be things that then fulfill the longer term goal, which is to train up a new generation of writers. Part of this change came about because I flagged up to Kat that I've reached a certain age. I'm now 61 and don't know exactly what this means or when it will happen, but I do intend to retire. And whether retire means slow down or means stop entirely and just, you know, have fun and read books and watch movies and just go to
smoke
restaurants.
Smoke your pipe and read Louis L'Amour novels.
Yes, I have to take up pipe smoking, I guess, in that scenario.
And Louis L'Amour, I think.
It's certainly not my goal to, you know, keel over in my 70s while writing a monster stat and hit the keyboard and die. And also other members of the creative team may be at or within hailing distance of that same age milestone. And so if Pelgrane is going to continue, if selfishly the things that I've worked on are going to continue to have a life and be supported and have other people respond to them and continue the design tradition, means we need to find new people other than the you and me and Gar and Rob and our other group of collaborators and bring people more online. And so something I have been doing in the background with unannounced projects that I'm commissioning is to bring in writers and try to train them in the gumshoe way. And so that's the other goal, is I'm taking this position in order to be able to replace myself as a writer, which means I also, since I'm beginning to, you know, put all these procedures in motion, and I will also have to be able to eventually replace myself as a creative director. So I'm in the final laps of my career, and there's an element of this, which is making sure that Pelgrane continues after I step back a bit.
So leaving aside questions of final laps, which strikes me as the wrong sports metaphor, final period, surely, being a Canadian, rather than just taking things off of Kat's plate and looking for the future Ken and Robin, is there sort of things that you are bringing into the mix that, because of your new exalted position, you are not able to bring into the mix as a mere beloved and trusted core writer?
The mix is not going to change. I think the main goal is to get more things coming out and more support for different games, so that we're not going, you know, a year or 2 years without any support for one of our main games, and also to keep bringing new games online and having new creators make those games. So it's a slight adjustment. So for example, there are things that you've been pitching for years that have gone from maybe to if you write it, we'll print it.
Right.
And so that's as close as I could say to adding new things to the mix. So far, it's about going through the inventory of stuff that we've got and getting that moving. And so at a greater time horizon, I might be looking at things and going, well, what's the next thing that the line needs? The next big design development that Pelgrane needs is something that I'm working on myself and haven't announced yet. And that is something that is both a new thing, but also an obvious new step based on what we've already done. And another thing I'm trying to do is just sort of set policies in place so that what we're announcing and what comes out makes more sense to people. So, for example, in the past, we've gotten all excited about a project and then at our meeting before Gen Con and then gone to the Gen Con panel and announced that project. And then that project has not even had an outline years after that.
Right.
And so that creates the illusion that our books are not coming out in time. And so what I want to do is have books that are actually underway and relatively close to coming out and then start to promote them. It's not a problem to have awareness for a game build for a while, but if you let it go for too long, it starts to frustrate people and feel that they're being sold vaporware. It
becomes a trivia question they ask on the Discord, not a real product.
Yeah. And so the next time we come up with a cool idea that can't get started until all of the writers have time to do it, I'm going to wait until the writers have at least started to do it or even have, you know, initial drafts in before we start to promote it. And also the other side of that is to get art moving sooner and get art commissioned so that we have, when we're announcing something, we have its actual cover and not like a placeholder that I, with my non-existent art skills, have cobbled together from collage elements.
And on the topic of art, that has been one of the myriad things that Kat has been doing is trying to art direct every line in the company. And you are now, I know, art directing at least some, maybe all of the books that are not 13th Age books. Is one of your jobs to find an art director so that you don't wind up doing an other full-time job in half of your half-time job?
The plan is to have an art director who isn't me. I don't think I will be hiring the art director. I think that'll be Kat. But yeah, the issue is, since Kat and Simon want to grow the company and ensure its future, is that there are all sorts of things that could be solved by hiring more people.
Yeah.
But that can only be done
once books come out.
Yeah. Even if there was a mountain of cash to start paying people more, even then, you couldn't bring everybody in at once. And so we're still in a transitional period where we need a bunch of people. We need to sort of staff up in an organized way. Because as you well know, Ken, one of the ways that mid-tier publishing companies kill themselves is by hiring too many people too fast and having too big a payroll for their cash flow. And so we have to be careful not to do that. As much as I would love to take some of the jobs that I've accidentally acquired and farm them out to other people.
On a final up note, maybe give us a little, you know, when I was brought in, there were no projects in the pipeline. Now there are X number of projects. Give us a rousing statistic, socialist productivity 5-year plan style to send us out of this.
Right. So if everything goes according to plan, we have had a drought in releases. You may have noticed as listeners of the show that the Borealis ad went on for a year and a half, which suggested how long it was without a release.
New release.
And now in 2026 will be the year of regular releases. And so 13th Age is shipping to backers, and then we'll ship to retail, then page turners, and then there'll be a bunch of other books leading up to Trail Second Edition. There's also the Fear Itself, Shattered Veil Edition stuff. So we will start, 2026 will be the year of regular releases. And instead of having nothing, we're starting to test how many releases we can actually have and have the people who play Pelgrane games absorb. And so we're going from one issue to another. So the question then is to make sure all of that happens and start to be a company with a schedule of releases. And eventually, the most exciting statistic will be us being able to give people reliable release dates. So that's possibly 2027 is the year of the reliable release date, after 2026 is the year of many products coming out.
Well, you can't ask for a bolder and more ambitious statement than that. So I think on that note, we will play another ad, not for Pelgrane products, but for one of our many beloved mid-tier game company co-fraternus. And from that point, lever ourselves into yet another hut or segment.
December 5th, 1775. A wagon train led by bookseller-turned-artillery officer Henry Knox arrives at Fort Ticonderoga in upstate New York.
His goal, haul captured British cannons through the snowy mountains to the siege of Boston and drive the Redcoats from the cradle of liberty.
This year, Henry Knox's noble train of artillery delivers presents not to General Washington, but to you!
In Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Visit nationsandcannons.com and use promo code CANNON at checkout for 17.75% off and free PDFs of your books. The clacking of time gears and the whirring of chronotons tell us we're once more standing in proximity to Ken's time machine. This, of course, is the conveyance that Ken's superiors at Time Incorporated used to send him back into history to bend, fold, spindle, and sometimes, yes, even mutilate it. And this time around, beloved Patreon backer Justin Maharab asks, what happens if Bugsy Siegel isn't talked out of killing Joseph Goebbels and Hermann Göring at a 1939 party in Italy? It's a fascinating alternate timeline with a fascinating real history until the divergence point. So the obvious place to start, Ken, is with someone who you should never refer to when you meet him in the time stream as Bugsy. He doesn't like that at all.
Does not.
Benjamin Siegel.
Right. He's born in 1906 in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. He very rapidly becomes a teen criminal with the Lawrence Street Gang. And then in 1920, so 14, 15, he's teaming up with Meyer Lansky. Why have we not had the CW show about Bugs and Meyer running around ganking mobsters and protecting and then extorting Jewish grocers? They set up extortion, enforcement, and bootlegging. And this is as telegenic teenagers. So what's better than that? Eventually, they come to the attention of the sort of the real mob, and Frank Costello and Lucky Luciano become serially their patrons. He then is teaming up with other mostly Jewish triggermen as Murder Incorporated. And this is the name that basically, you know, Meyer Lansky is moving into management. Bugs is staying hands on. And so they become Murder Incorporated in 1930-ish. And they are the key killers in the Castellamarese War between Lucky Luciano and his opponents, including eventually Frank Costello. So keep your eye on the ball, kids. And eventually out of that war comes the Syndicate. And this is just called the Crime Syndicate of America, apparently, but we refer to it as the Syndicate. And Bugsy says, the Syndicate needs a permanent enforcement branch, and guess who should run it? Me. And Luciano owes him the favor, so he gets to do it. But Luciano is not such a fool as to leave Bugsy Siegel sitting around wondering what happened to his old boss. So Lucky and Meyer say, why don't you go to California, Bugs? That'd be good. There's a lot of money out there, and we'd like a part of it. So 1933, he goes out to California for the first time, and at the Santa Anita racetrack meets the former Dorothy Caldwell Taylor, since 1923, the Countess di Frasso, the wife of the Count Dentis di Frasso, or Carlo Dentis di Frasso, and she falls head over heels for the really remarkably good-looking Bugsy Siegel, and he becomes her side piece, taking the place in her heart and bed that was formerly occupied by Gary Cooper. Cooper, by now, is glad to be out of it, so no hard feelings at all.
Right, and there's lots of talk at this time of Siegel possibly being movie star material. There's even, he almost even takes a screen test. He's so good looking, but he's got some skeletons in his closet that even the studio PR system couldn't cover up.
Right. He's buddies with Jack Warner. He's buddies with George Raft. He hangs out with Clark Gable. He's definitely part of the Hollywood scene in this era. Dorothy, the Countess, is 18 years his senior. So, and Bugsy is also dating around other starlets, but she's his main squeeze and he's her main side piece. So in 35, he moves out to California full time.
And in 1937, you can interact with him in the Cthulhu Confidential scenario, The Fathomless Sleep,
right,
in which he plays a role. And that's the scenario where famously players are more frightened of the real life mob figures that they have to get information from than they are with the cultists and ghouls.
Yes. And again, this comes from knowing stuff about Bugsy. In 1938, he goes off with the Countess to hunt for pirate treasure on Cocos Island off Costa Rica. The Countess loves a get-rich-quick story, possibly because she has recognized there's not a lot of money in being an Italian countess, and she has a lifestyle to keep up. Part of it is just she has a romantic spirit. That's the kind of person who wants to, you know, bang Bugsy Siegel. So what's wrong with that? And they hire a Nazi boat captain, literal German Nazi, named Robert Hoffmann, and he takes a motley crew, including one of Jack Warner's close friends or relatives, I'm not quite sure which, out to the island, and they dig around, and they officially do not find any pirate treasure. Bugsy gets bored and flies back to L.A. from Panama, but he is not over the Countess, and she's not over get-rich-quick schemes. She meets a couple of chemists who sell her on a new explosive that they have named radium atomite, or possibly just atomite. And it's supposed to be an explosive that has no smoke, no flash, and no sound when it goes off. It's a silent killer. And they test it out in the desert, and she's so impressed that she buys a majority share, buys the patents of Atomite, buys the majority share in the chemist's company, and she gets her husband to set it up with Count Ciano, the foreign minister of Mussolini, that they should try selling Atomite to Mussolini. And Mussolini says, new explosive, sounds great. And he sends them, advances them 40 grand, and so they go to Italy to sell Atomite, and this is in April of 1939 that Bugsy and the Countess, not the two scientists apparently, head out to do this sales pitch. When they get there, either because there are no scientists there or because the Atomite is a bit of a snake oil explosive, it doesn't detonate. It just, the demo literally fizzles. Mussolini is mad and says, give me my money back.
I love that, you know, even adjusted for inflation, I love the part of this story where Mussolini is fussed about 40 grand.
40 grand. I mean, in 1939, that was real money. But yeah, I mean, Mussolini, I guess, didn't get to where he was without worrying about incidentals. And so he wants his money back. The Countess promises to pay it back, and he's still mad at her. So he throws her out of her own house, the historical Villa Madama in Rome. He says, I'm sorry, we need this for an actually important guest who will do what he says, and that is Hermann Göring, head of the Luftwaffe. Maybe you've heard of it. And Dorothy and Bugsy have to go live in the stables, which are still nice, but I mean, Dorothy has put like $1 million into refurbishing this villa. It's the premier party spot in Rome, and she's fuming that she's been bounced out of it.
Yes, and Siegel is not taking it well either, and
no,
has a temper and knows how to shoot guns.
Right. And Justin's original question references Goebbels, because that's what showed up in the original biography of Bugsy, a book called We Only Kill Each Other. A lovely book full of heartwarming anecdotes told in the tone of someone recalling in safety something that happened 35 years ago. But you can look into it, and Goebbels is not at the villa. He is, in fact, on the island of Rhodes on vacation, and then got brought back to stage manage Hitler's birthday. So he could not have stopped.
So you would have to time machine him there.
Right. Or it would have to be a sort of a Inglorious Bastards thing where, why not? Let's just add Goebbels. So anyway, Siegel, who is, let us just say, an indifferent Jew in the best of circumstances, does realize that Jews and Nazis should not be getting along, and says, what if I just went and whacked Göring? And Dorothy says, well, if you did that, Bugsy, probably says Ben, and he says, look at the setup. It would be easy. I could easily do it. And she says, well, yes, but then you would still be in Mussolini's Rome, and my husband would still be here, and I would still be here, and best case scenario, we lose the villa permanently, and worst case scenario, everyone involved is executed to make Hitler happy, so don't do that. And Siegel says, all right, for you, baby, I won't do it, but I'm going to bitch about it continuously for the rest of my life, which in fact he does. He was still whining about it to his daughter years later. So it stuck in his craw, this bad treatment by fascists. So that is what actually happened. They get back on the boat, slink back to America with their tail between their legs. And by the time they get back, Dorothy has lost her position as society hostess because the FBI has been interested in this treasure excavation because they think he's been hiding Louis Lepke on this treasure boat, and the FBI turned the whole thing over and started investigating stuff. And
explain who Louis Lepke is for those.
He's another member of Murder Incorporated that they were trying to find. Turns out he was on Coney Island the whole time, different island, but they were still looking for him. And so the FBI blows up Siegel's sort of, you know, oh, I used to be a bootlegger Jay Gatsby type cover with, no, he's a multiple murderer. And so even Jack Warner has second thoughts about associating his talent with that kind of person. And Bogart makes a statement about, you know, bootleggers and paper millionaires. And so the Hollywood colony turns on Ben Siegel, and he has to devote his time to building Las Vegas and dating a different lady, Virginia Hill, as it happens.
So I guess this point is the time when we pose the question, did you engineer the other timeline or have you merely observed it? Is a good timeline result from Bugsy shooting Goering and Gables, who in this scenario, the chrononaut would have gotten onto the scene.
Goebbels is, just to get him out of the way fast, Goebbels is in that sort of subset of competent Nazis. So shooting him would make Nazi propaganda somewhat less effective. But the problem is, it was never that effective in the West or in Russia anyway. So it is purely an internal matter. And one of the problems with living under a dictatorship is your internal discontent does not have a lot of immediate application point. So losing Goebbels, you know, we lose a bunch of wonderful German films, I'm sure.
It means worse graphic design.
But it means worse graphic design and, you know, cluttered posters. It doesn't mean, you know, Hitler loses. Although I guess his birthday is ruined. So that's good. You made Hitler sad. But the trouble is Goering is in the other category of incompetent Nazis. And when you kill Goering, he is going to be replaced, at least initially, by his deputy, who's a guy named Erhard Milch. And Milch is the guy who basically kept the Luftwaffe running, even though it was run by Goering. And he was a devotee, for example, of mass production of proven models instead of chasing a bunch of nonsense prototypes. He's like, we've got the ME-109. Let's just build 100,000 of those. Let's not keep trying to engineer a better fighter. Yes, I know there are better fighters, but those better fighters are 18 months away and will use huge resources, whereas we could just build another 10 ME-109s for that same money. So that puts more fighter planes in the air. He is also a devotee of the heavy bomber program, which has opposition at every level of the Reich. In 1943, he's able to push it through in our timeline. If he's running the Luftwaffe, he probably gets it pushed through by 1940. And the Germans having a heavy bomber for the Battle of Britain and for the invasion of Russia, not a good look. He also is a get-along guy. He works well with the other branches. He works well with the Kriegsmarine and with the Wehrmacht. He's great buddies with Kesselring, who at this point is running one of the Luftflotte and is a Wehrmacht officer. So there's not the sort of glory-hogging, I can do it, my Führer type stuff that Goering used to do. So Goering, as it transpires, when you look at it, managed to screw up Dunkirk by not taking out the British pocket, screwed up the Battle of the Atlantic by not cooperating with the Kriegsmarine to hunt submarine hunters, screwed up the Battle of Britain by switching focus from counter-radar to counter-force, and screwed up Stalingrad by saying, if you're, I can rescue that army group that is isolated. And of course, he couldn't rescue the army group. He couldn't even keep them supplied. So you have changes to all of those battles, and the common thread there is those are all Allied victories. So you're not necessarily going to win the war for the Nazis because they're still short of strategic metals. They're still short of fuel. They're still short of a lot of stuff. But the war goes on long enough that maybe Berlin gets the A-bomb instead of Hiroshima, which is, I think, differently unideal. And of course, he's also less politically secure than Goering because Milch is rumored to be Jewish because his father is apparently of Jewish ancestry. And so he has to get his mom to sign an affidavit that says he's a bastard or maybe the product of incest to get out of being investigated for being Jewish. The Gestapo investigates him twice. Goering shuts them down both times. So without Goering, obviously, he's got no protection except Hitler. But that also means he can't do the kind of empire building and nonsense that Goering did, where he took all of his Luftwaffe and turned them into ground forces. That was just ridiculousness. Milk would not be doing that. So Milk would be a better, more obedient Luftwaffe guy and stop herring off on his own ridiculous notions. So you've extended the war. You've probably really messed up Britain. And at the very least, you've made the East Front take longer than it should. So I say killing Goering, bad news, and I'm against it. So I peeked into that universe and saw the absence of Goering, that great fat shadow withdrawn from the Luftwaffe, not a good look.
So you helped the Countess talk Bugsy out of it.
Right, exactly. I show back up and I show up with some Aperol spritzes and say, hey guys, let's take a moment and think about this. Mr. Siegel, Countess, just a thought, but what if you don't get hung, you know, by a meat hook? That's how they hang you here. And I feel like Siegel, having seen plenty of kosher butchers in his day, would say, ooh, that doesn't look good. I don't like it. I'm going to go back to Hollywood.
Right. And even if nothing much happening in this incident is what needs to happen for the timeline to heal, we can certainly look back to the hunt for pirate treasure as a clear scenario hook as ever there was.
Yes.
And whenever we find an absolutely clear scenario hook at the end of our episode, it's the end of our episode.
It is.
We'll be back next week with more just like this. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Palgrain Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep this podcast's ancient city undestroyed by joining such backers as...
Toonspew.
Alan McSager.
Jeff Cars.
Jean-Francois Paradis.
And Mark Waterhouse.
Where this show or drink it from a mug with Ken Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindelaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when once again, we will talk about stuff.